You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, from L.A. to New York, on Sirius XM, all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by Free Speech TV. More people watching or listening to the Tom Hartman Program and more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Glad to have you with us. Wow. Mitt Romney, 13.9% of paying his income tax rates. We will get into that. Mitch Daniels is going to give the rebuttal to the State of the Union address tonight. Mitch Daniels, who's legislature, his Republican legislature, just yesterday passed a right to work for less, the first Midwestern industrial state to say, hey, yeah, let's go with the right to work for less thing. And so keep in mind when you hear Mitch Daniels talking tonight that that's the guy. He's the right to work for less guy, the let's screw the working people guy. We're going to get into Mitt Romney's what's going on with Mitt Romney. And also, just a few thoughts on last night's debate. It was more, I think, more heat than light. Not even that much heat, but anyhow. But tonight, the President of the United States will be speaking in the one speech that the Constitution mandates he give. Actually, it doesn't mandate it be a speech. The first few times it was written and handed out to members of Congress. And Thomas Jefferson was so shy, he got James Madison to read it for him. But nonetheless, every year the Constitution says the president has to report to Congress on the State of the Union, and that will happen tonight. Brian Deese is on the line with us. He's the Deputy Director of the National Economic Council Special Assistant to the President of the United States. Whitehouse.gov/administration-OEP-NEC. There's a link over at our website. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand that Warren Buffett's secretary, Debbie Bosnick, is going to be sitting with the First Lady tonight in the gallery. Now, Buffett has famously suggested that since he pays 15% income tax, which is even more than Mitt Romney pays, and his secretary pays 30-something, that just ain't right. And the president's calling this the Buffett rule. Is this an indicator we should expect the Buffett rule to be pitched tonight?
Well, Tom, as you know, it's tradition for the First Lady to invite a set of people from across the country to sit with her and watch the speech, and it's a good view from up there in the chamber. And I think that you can certainly expect that the president is going to talk about tax reform and his view on whether and how the most fortunate in this country should pay their fair share. And as you pointed out, you know, Warren Buffett has really crystallized this issue and brought it to life by juxtaposing his own situation with that of his secretary. But I think the president thinks about this in a broader scope, which is if we are going to reform our tax code and we're going to do it in a way that reduces complexity for the vast majority of the American people, we should commit that we are going to observe the very basic principle, which is that the wealthiest Americans should not pay lower taxes than middle-class families. And so I think that that's something that the president feels strongly about, and I think you'll hear him talking about tonight.
You know, the last president to speak out on that point, specifically the point that we have two tax rates, one for capitalists and one for workers, and that capitalist in the classic sense of the word, that is somebody who earns their living with capital, with money, as opposed to earning their living by the sweat of their brow or the labor of their arm or back, and was Ronald Reagan when he lowered the ordinary income tax rate down to 28% and raised the capitalist gains tax up to 28% and came right out and said, you know, capitalists who earn their money basically just sitting on their butt all day, you know, sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive should at least pay the same income tax rate as the pool guy who's cleaning the pool. That wasn't the metaphor that Reagan used. It's one of my more favorite ones, but essentially the same thing. And everybody seems to have forgotten that Reagan said that and that he did that and that for only a year or so those two rates were the same. Is the president going to refer to that kind of thing? Is he going to call for the capitalist gains tax to be the same as the ordinary income or the earned income tax? The ordinary income tax?
Well, given that we're only a couple hours away, I'm not going to get in front of exactly what the president's going to talk about, but I will make a couple points. First, I think you're absolutely right to point out the fact that there does seem to be a bit of amnesia around the basic fact that in the late 1980s, we had a tax system where the capital gains rate was at 28. And I also think that there's a bit of amnesia about the fact that in the 1990s, while you didn't have the same marginal rates on ordinary income and capital gains, you had a top individual income tax rate at 39.6%. And a lot of the people who today are suggesting that it would be the end of our economy as we know it if we return to that were some of the same people who take credit for the economic gains, the widely shared economic gains that we saw in the 1990s.
Yeah, so, I found it mind-boggling last night when on the Republican stage in the debate, Newt Gingrich took credit for balanced budgets when he was Speaker of the House, when he was the guy who stood on the floor of the House of the Representatives the first time that Bill Clinton proposed raising that top marginal tax rate from 36 up to 39%, and said, if this is done, we will experience a Great Depression worse than the one of the 1930s. And no Republican in the House voted for that tax increase. None. And, I mean, this was after they had lost their majority, but this was what Newt was saying, and now he's taking credit for it?
Look, again, I think what we need is a little honest reflection and serious investigation around tax policy and economic growth in this country, because when you look at the 1990s, you saw a period of strong gains where you saw a tax system that had, you know, very clear attributes like a 39.6% top rate. And likewise, in the last decade, we saw the slowest rate of job creation of any expansion or so-called expansion since World War II, while at the same time experiencing massive tax rate reductions, particularly targeted at the highest income individuals that were not paid for. So, you know, I think that it's we need to figure out how to have an honest conversation about it.
I absolutely agree. Brian, to shift to trade policies, when Reagan came into office, the average tariff on imported goods into the United States was in the mid-20s. And that's one of the main reasons why we still made things in the United States. It had been there since the George Washington administration, since Alexander Hamilton had proposed it in 1791, and it was adopted in 1793. And it had never gone below 20%. It had gone above 40% a couple of times, but very rarely. And it had usually been in that average around 30% rate. Since the Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush administrations, each one consecutively has dropped that down to less than 1%. The other countries of the world are using a value-added tax to have the effect of a tariff. England is now raising theirs to 20% from 16%. Most other countries are around 16%. Shouldn't we have some sort of a tax policy that brings manufacturing back?
Well, again, without getting into specifics, what I can tell you is that, you know, when the president lays out his blueprint tonight, which he will describe as a blueprint for an economy that's built to last, one of the key planks of that is American manufacturing and answering the basic question of how can we as a country make sure that we continue to make things in this country, because that's not only about good jobs, though at the end of the day, it's incredibly important for that. It's also important for driving innovation in this country, for driving wage gains in this country, for driving basic research and the kind of things that
and for self-sufficiency.
And for some,
I mean, you know, during World War II, we could actually make our own weapons. Right now, we can't make a cruise missile without parts from China.
I think that's right. And as you say, some of that is tax policy, and those are issues that the president is going to get into. But there's more there, too. We need to be willing to step up and make the kinds of investments in basic research.
That's great. Brian, we're out of time, but well said. Thank you very much for being with us, Brian Deese.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's going to be an interesting evening between the president coming out and speaking, and then Mitch Daniels, the guy who's trying to bust unions and destroy workers, giving the rebuttal. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And here, Mitt Romney, you know, Newt's got his panties in a water. A lot of people do about the fact that he's paying 13.9%, that he paid 13.9% in income taxes total whereas Warren Buffett's secretary pays 35-36%. And frankly, I think that instead of inviting, or in addition to inviting, Debbie Bosanek, who for 20 years was Warren Buffett's secretary, to sit next to the First Lady tonight, she should have found one of Mitt Romney's former secretaries, who also, you know, paid 30% to sit next to her. That would be the ultimate, you know, of course, that would be really politicizing the State of the Union, and this president has way too much class to do that, you know, or to lie to us like George Bush did when he used the State of the Union to say, we have evidence of Saddam Hussein. Or England has evidence that Saddam Hussein is looking for uranium in Africa. Yeah, right. Turns out it was a lie, and Joe Wilson said so and paid the price, and his wife got outed, and crimes were committed by Dick Cheney, and nothing was ever done. And anyhow, the bottom line here, Mitt Romney paying so little income tax and making so much money. Did you know that in a day, Mitt Romney makes more than the average American makes in a year? And that in a week, from Saturday to Saturday, Mitt Romney makes enough to put him in the top 1% of Americans if he made nothing else for the next 51 weeks. This is pretty mind-boggling. I mean, this guy makes $40 million a year. And the percentage of his income last year that he paid into Social Security, 0.1%. Now, if you make less than $106,000 a year, you know what the percentage is that you paid into Social Security? 7.65%, almost 8%. Mitt Romney, 0.1%. If that, frankly. He's got accounts in the Cayman Islands and Luxembourg. He used to have a Swiss bank account. He closed it in 2010 when he decided to run for president. Now, I lived in Germany back in the 80s. And I had to have a bank account in Germany. I had a German bank account because I lived there. And, you know, you got to have a bank. And I thought, you know, all my life I've heard about Swiss bank accounts and how cool they are. And how cool would it be to have a Swiss bank account? And I'm in the country right next door and they speak the same language. And my German was fairly functional. And so I contacted a couple of Swiss banks and said, you know, hey, how about I open a Swiss bank account? Maybe I can even keep that when I go back to the United States, because you can't do that with a German bank account. I mean, you can now, but you couldn't back then. And they said, oh, we'd be very happy to take your money. We'll provide all the services that normal banks do. And you only have to pay us 3% interest. And wait a minute. Don't banks pay me? Don't you pay me interest when I deposit money with you? Oh, no. The way that Swiss bank accounts work is you pay us. And I'm like, why would anybody pay a Swiss bank interest to have a checking or savings account in a Swiss bank? And the answer was because of our secrecy laws, because nobody will ever know that your money's here. So why does Mitt Romney have a Swiss bank account? Or why did he? This is just asking a few questions. And then here's where it gets really bizarre. Newt Gingrich has this great tax plan. He wants to take capital gains. This is the money that Paris Hilton makes sitting around the pool, you know, in her bikini, waiting for the dividend check to arrive for the money that she inherited from her parents that is invested. She makes her money basically the same way that Mitt Romney does, investments. Newt Gingrich wants Paris Hilton to pay nothing in taxes. And Mitt Romney seemed a little astounded by that last night. Clip number 4, Jacob. Here it is.
Mr. Speaker, is the tax on capital gains also 15% or is it zero?
Zero.
Well, under that plan, I'd have paid no taxes in the last 2 years.
Right. You're in $40 million. You pay no taxes at all. That's the Newt Gingrich plan. I mean, even Mitt Romney doesn't have the stupidity, frankly, to propose that. I mean, he's in the 0.1%. He's in the 1% just from 1 week's income. Just incredible. Just absolutely incredible. And to discuss his taxes today, he had to hire a former IRS commissioner and 4 lawyers just to discuss his taxes. Well, if you make $40 million and you want to shelter your income and you've got Cayman Islands accounts and Swiss accounts and Luxembourg accounts and you don't work for any of that, as Mitt Romney famously said, I'm unemployed, have been for a decade. if that's how you earn your money is, you know, in this case, walking around various states pretending to run for president or actually running for president. But he could just as easily be sitting on his butt around the pool on his mansion in California that he's tearing, his 3,000-foot mansion he's tearing down to build a 12,000-foot mansion, or one of his other mansions. If that's how you earn your living, you know, maybe at that point, I don't know, at that point Mitt Romney kind of shut up. I expected him to say something like, you know, I mean, he said, well, that means, play the last 10 seconds of that clip if you can again, Jacob. It's
well, under that plan, I'd have paid no taxes in the last 2 years.
And then all of a sudden he shut up. Like, you know, he was thinking, gee, maybe I should endorse Mitt or Newt. I don't know. By the way, did you know that newts, salamanders, are the only vertebrate animals, the only animals with a spine, with a backbone, who can regenerate their hearts, who can regenerate their limbs, who can regenerate their jaws, who can regenerate their eyes, but they can regenerate their hearts, which might account for why a newt could function for a while without its heart. Which, you know, suddenly some of Newt's campaign rhetoric makes sense, right? I kid the newtster. But anyway, we'll see what the talking points are. And I'm going to be listening very carefully to see what the president has to say tonight. I think, and I strongly believe, that having a VAT tax, a value-added tax, on manufactured goods in the United States, that you can reverse out when you export things, functions as a tariff, which is why Japan, China, England, Germany, it's why all these other countries do it. We should too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or go back to a tariff-based system. By the way, front page of the Financial Times, they're taking on Mitt Romney's business. I'll tell you about that after this, and we'll pick up your calls. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, let's just, you know, to put a fine point on it, but I figured it was implicit, but I want to make it explicit. Just because somebody earns a whole bunch of money and doesn't pay a lot of taxes doesn't make them a bad person. It, you know, makes them somebody who is successful and is playing by the rules in most cases. And, you know, on that level, you can't say, hey, Mitt Romney, you're a bad guy because you did this. I mean, he's just following the rules. What's wrong is that the rules have been gamed. Now, who has gamed the rules? Why is it that capitalists pay 15% income tax and workers pay 36% income tax? Well, the reason, very simply, is because the capitalists had enough money to pay off a bunch of members of Congress to change the tax code. But I don't know that Romney did that. Although people like Newt Gingrich, you know, Newt, who made $30 million trading on his insider status as former Speaker of the House, would like to pay no income taxes. Also want to talk about the right to work for less. They call it right to work, but it's actually the right to work for less. The average worker in a right to work for less state makes about $5,300 a year less than in states that haven't opted in under Taft-Hartley and become right to work for less states. Here's how it used to be. In 1935, when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, what it said was, if more than half of the workers in a company vote to have a union, then you've got a union. Now, that union negotiates on behalf of all the workers. Therefore, all the workers who are getting the benefit of the union being there. And keep in mind, at any point, 51% of the workers can decertify the union. They can do away with it. All of the workers who are getting the benefit have to pay union dues. Real simple. So that was 1935. 1947, Taft-Hartley comes along. This was passed by a Republican House, the Republican Senate, which, you know, the Republicans took control of the House and Senate in 46, and they held it for 2 years. Then they lost it for another 26 years, but they held it for 2 years. And they passed Taft-Hartley. President Truman vetoed it. They overrode his veto. It became law. And what Taft-Hartley said was that if an individual state's legislature passes a law saying it doesn't want to be bound by the provisions of the Wagner Act, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, then You can have a union in a shop, but everybody doesn't have to pay pay union dues, even though they're getting the benefits of the union. So what it did, basically what it does, becoming a so-called right-to-work state, a right-to-work-for-less state, what it does is it pits workers against workers. It makes it harder to unionize. It makes it harder to maintain a union. And it creates animosity. Because you got some workers who are saying, yeah, I don't want to pay any union dues. Which means that all of the cost of having the union and negotiating and doing the things that the union does has to be paid by, you know, 51% basically of the workers, so that 49% can get a free ride. And those people start looking at each other like, you know, okay, who's the freeloader here, you know, or who's trying to make me pay and all that kind of stuff, right? It sets up internecine warfare, which is why Republicans want to do it. It's why Mitch Daniels has been pushing this legislation in Indiana, which was passed one of the houses. I believe it passed the Senate last night, and it has to go through their House of Representatives, and then he signs it into law. And Mitch Daniels now is, they're talking about, well, if there's a brokered convention and nobody wants Romney and nobody wants Gingrich, maybe Mitch Daniels will be the Republican nominee. So let's put him out there and make him the guy who does the rebuttal to the president in the State of the Union address. Be aware, when that guy gives his speech tonight, that he's the man who's trying to destroy workers' rights in the state of Indiana, and not just trying to, is almost certainly going to. 21% more people lack health insurance and right to work for less states compared to free bargaining states. Right to work for less states have a poverty rate of 12.5% compared to 10.2% in other states. Infant mortality is 16% higher in right to work for less states. Why? Because people make less money. And they don't have medical benefits. According to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, the rate of workplace deaths is 51% higher in states with right to work for less. In other words, where basically you don't have a union. You can get this and a lot of other stats over at the AFL-CIO's website. If you just Google right to work for less, a phrase that I thought I invented several years ago. I've been pitching it to union leaders for years, but now they're using it. I don't know if I invented it. It probably goes back to 1947. But I don't think that we should ever say right to work, because it's not the right to work. It's the right to work for less. Everybody has the right to work, with or without legislation. So, anyhow, John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to quickly say that there is a revenue collection problem, and that they either find loopholes or they actually are rich enough to hire enough tax attorneys to manipulate the system so that they can offshore money in these offshore accounts, and the federal government does not collect what they need to collect to pay for a lot of our programs. And the way that the Republicans respond to that, instead of closing these loopholes or even enforcing the IRS code, let's just cut Social Security, cut this, cut that, and allow people to still illegally or quasi-legally hide money. And a former senator from this state tried to address that issue, but I don't think he really got very much traction.
You're talking about Minnesota. Which senator are you talking about?
Wellstone.
Oh, Paul. Of course, Paul Wellstone. Let me tell you, it's even worse than that. It's not that they find loopholes. It's that in many cases, the people who are just, you know, engaged in rampant tax evasion, basically, lobby for loopholes. You know, they donate money to politicians who, like Newt Gingrich, go out and say, okay, and I'm going to get rid of the tax rate. And so, John, thank you for that. You know, well said and well identified. It is the system that is broken. It's not rich people who are broken. I mean, you know, some of them are just, you know, Warren Buffett, second richest guy in America, his secretary, he supports the president on this. You know, he says, I should pay more taxes. There's some good rich guys out there. And what are they saying? They're saying the system is broken. The system is broken. Steve in San Luis Obispo, listening on KYNS. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Congratulations on confronting Brian with what is Obama going to talk about raising, equalizing the rates, same rate on capital gains as ordinary income.
Yeah.
That's the question I put to you in December 2010 when there was discussion of extending the Bush tax cuts.
Yep.
And we
and by the way, the Bush tax cuts dropped the capital gains rate from 20% down to 15%.
Yeah, well, I was talking to you about that. Therefore, there was a tremendous resistance to having from the top tenth of a percent
right.
to having their tax rates raised 33% from 15% to 20%.
Right.
And also, as we discussed, Clinton didn't block. He signed the reduction from 28% to 20%, which Bush then took down to 15, as you just said.
Yeah, it wasn't 28, though, when Clinton came in. It had been dropped from 28. It only stayed at 28 during the Reagan administration for like a year or two. Either Reagan dropped it
you're right about that.
George W. Bush.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure Reagan dropped it.
Yeah, it was Reagan, Bradley, Gephardt. We talked about that.
Yeah.
We also talked about the tax cheats, which are estimated to cost the revenue of $200 billion a year. Your previous caller hit that. That's an explosive issue.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Steve. And again, and to the previous caller, and thank you for the call. It even gets worse than that. When George W. Bush was president, he said to the IRS, take a bunch of your IRS inspectors who on an average audit of a rich person, you know, it costs a few thousand dollars to have the inspector do it. And nets in I don't have the numbers in front of me here any longer, but they net multiples of what it costs. Take those inspectors off auditing rich people. Let's slow down the rate at which we're auditing rich people and audit more average working people, which is crazy. I mean, you know, and it doesn't produce the kind of input that you want. Noel in Spring City, Tennessee. Hey, Noel, what's up?
I'm very well, thank you. I was told years ago, about 1975, by a professor friend of mine from Canada, that the American electoral system was destined to fail. He said it was a mindless power machine that was directed and followed money.
Yeah.
I didn't think a lot of it at the time, but I can see that he was correct.
And the villain in this story is the Supreme Court.
Yes.
The Supreme Court, ever since from 1886, Santa Clara County, they didn't decide it, but the head note said it. Corporations are persons. Fast forward to the 1970s, Buckley versus Vallejo. Money is equal to speech, or money facilitates speech. Fast forward to the 1980s, First National Bank versus Pilati. Corporations have the right to speak. They're persons. Fast forward to Citizens United, and the whole thing goes on steroids. And
yes.
The Supreme Court was never elected by any of us, and the Constitution does not give them the power to make laws or to define doctrines. They have taken that power onto themselves in their 1803 Marbury versus Madison case, which should be reversed. Noel, thank you. Well said. And this is the problem that we have in the United States right now, is that we have five guys in black robes sitting about three blocks from where I am right now here in Washington, D.C., who are basically ruling this country like kings. It's wrong. It's unconstitutional.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Debbie Bozanek. I wonder how many people are going to know her name really, really well after tonight. Warren Buffett's secretary.
Talk to me. Come on now, talk to me. Talk to me.
Oh, this is pretty incredible. 1993. You know, somebody called yesterday and said, you know, do you think Newt Gingrich is, or actually they asserted that Newt Gingrich was racist because he calls the president the food stamp president and talks about how poor kids should work as janitors and all that kind of thing. So I find this particularly fascinating that in today's Think Progress, Marie Diamond, blogging at Think Progress Justice, thinkprogress.org right now, this just came out, that they found a 1993 speech. And I said at the time, I said, I don't know if Newt Gingrich is racist or if he's just playing one for political gain. I don't think that, frankly, Ronald Reagan was a racist. I think he just played one for political gain when he gave his first speech down in Philadelphia, Mississippi. But here are the handwritten notes from a speech that Newt Gingrich gave in 1993 He said, quote, "For poor minorities, entrepreneurship in small business is the key to future wealth. This is understood thoroughly by most of the Asians, partially by Latinos, and to a tragically small degree by much of the American black community." Wow. You know, if it wasn't for African Americans, for the institutional racism in the society that you've seen this in study after study after study, where equally qualified black people and white people apply for jobs, or names that look African American versus names that look Anglo-Saxon are submitted. Who gets the callback? The person with the name that looks Anglo-Saxon. I mean, this is just so well documented. If it wasn't for that institutional racism, then you wouldn't have illegal entrepreneurialism in the United States. And obviously it's not just in communities of color, but it's in communities of poverty where people are dealing drugs or dealing guns or whatever. I mean, that it's an entrepreneurial effort. It's not, it's an attempt to deal with the racism of society, not because there's a lack of understanding of how to make money. I'm just astounded by Newt Gingrich saying this, it's a situation that does not lend itself to sound bites, so I'll just leave it at that. William in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, William, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? The reason why I called was I saw
you. William, you just got really, really faint. Did you put your thumb over the microphone or something?
No, I didn't.
Ah, there you go. Now you're loud.
Okay. The reason why I called was I saw on your show where tonight the president's going to give the State of the Union address.
That's right.
And he's going to talk about the middle class, and he talked about two other subjects. Anyway, I read an article last time he gave the State of the Union address that talked about how he didn't address the plight of the poor. And it said that this was the first State of the Union address that the plight of the poor hadn't been addressed since the 1940s.
Okay.
And I was just wondering, you know, why? I mean, the poor vote too.
Why is the plight of the poor not addressed in the State of the Union address more often, and why might it not be addressed tonight? Lyndon Johnson addressed it a lot, by the way, and I'm not sure how often Ronald Reagan talked about the poor. But I would tell you that the reason why the poor, William, in general, are not addressed in the State of the Union address, and frankly, in not by members of Congress and things like that, and why Bill Clinton even felt comfortable saying we've ended welfare as we know it, is because you said the poor vote too. The fact of the matter is that in proportion to middle class and wealthy people, they don't. Poor people don't vote as often or as frequently. In many cases, because they're out there trying to find a job, you know, or they're broke, or they can't get to the polls, or whatever. I mean, there's a whole variety of reasons, and lack of education and other things too. And so, you know, this is a tragedy, but it's a tragedy that's not addressed in this country. In other countries, they have a social safety net that people don't fall through, and so you don't have the kinds of deep poverty that we have in the United States. I was just in Sweden the week before last, and in Iceland, and in those countries, you do not have the kind of poverty you have in the United States at all, period, because they have a social safety net. But that's why, William, and just, you know, tragically, but that's why. Shirley in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Shirley, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am fine, thank you. What's up?
Well, good. Good. Well, I just wanted to comment. A few minutes ago, you being fair, or maybe too nice, you said that you did not believe Newt Gingrich or President Reagan were racist. And I have to disagree because I do believe Newt Gingrich has he's a racist because he clearly have no problem in maligning African Americans when he sees fit, and I do believe he believes in white supremacy to a certain extent. He believes white people are better, he would say fundamentally better than black people, and that's why he's okay with saying the things he does.
It may well be. I mean, the speech of his from 1993 gives a lot of credibility to the position that you're taking, Shirley. I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. The fact of the matter is we're all racists at some level.
Yes. Oh, I know that. Yeah,
you know,
we're all racist, and it's to what extent
and
what you're aware. And, but,
right.
You know, I mean, just, you know, I just wanted to say that.
Okay. Well said. Thank you very much, Shirley. And you're welcome. I appreciate the call. Let's see here. Bobby in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Bobby. I got about a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi. I hope I have enough time to make a comment about Obama, but my question is sort of, in a sense, rhetorical and funny, is why can't Mitt Romney say, yeah, look, I'm good looking, I was born rich, I've had everything, I pay very little in taxes, and I've been faithful to one woman for 25 years, not a cheater like you who leaves your wife when she gets sick, and my wife, you know, and his wife does have.
Well, that's what he said in the debate before last. I mean, you know, he said, I've been married to the same woman for 40-some-odd years, and it was just, it was a clear slap at Newt. So, I don't, you know.
Not enough.
Yeah,
he really needs to be smacked up. My comment about Obama is, and I am putting this in another letter that will be ignored by Obama, is I believe, and yes, I'm voting for him, voted him in, but I don't believe him anymore, and my reasons are I believe he and his advisors have put in Reagan's regressive policies. Why would you not create jobs when you have Congress and a mandate? Why would you then put in...
Because he didn't have Congress. He didn't have 60 votes in the Senate. There were over 220 good pieces of legislation. Nancy Pelosi got out of the House. The Republicans blocked in the Senate. The first years.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Rodel Molyneux is with us. He is the president of the American Bridge PAC. Rodel, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. The American Bridge PAC. What's the American Bridge PAC all about? What do you do?
Well, American Bridge 21st Century, we are a research and candidate tracking political action committee. We do a few things. We do deep dive research on Republican candidates, and we also track their public events. And what we do is we take that research and we take that tracking and we look for contradictions in their public statements and their actions. And as you can imagine, we find a lot of it.
I would think so. Probably among Democrats as well, but good on somebody on you guys for looking at the Republicans. What are you finding about, and as a PAC, I mean, very often PACs are associated with specific candidates. Is your PAC associated with any candidate, or do you promote the interests of any candidate?
No. I mean, listen, we're a progressive organization.
Just a progressive
PAC. We're trying to make sure that America votes for and elects progressive candidates. But the work that we do, this is how we see it. You know, many times, especially in Republican primaries, you'll find these Republican candidates tack far to the right, and that's when they talk about doing away with Social Security and with Medicare, weakening labor laws. And then the day after that primary is over, they swing back to the middle and try to act as though they're as moderate as the day is long. And we think that voters have the right to know what these candidates really believe, what they really think, and we're trying to keep them honest. Make sure.
Sounds
that
like
they,
a plan. Rodel, your thoughts on the fact that Governor Romney earns more in one day than the average American earns in a year? That the working Americans can pay up to 35% in income taxes and almost 8% in payroll taxes, and Romney paid less than 0.1% in payroll taxes because they're capped out at $106,000, and he paid 13.9% in income taxes on his income. First of all, what's the meaning of all this? And secondly, what's the accuracy of it?
We here at American Bridge have been looking over this, and we believe it's accurate. There's still some things that I think we're going to need to see. This is just a piece of the puzzle. I think if Mitt Romney really wants to be transparent, he will go back and release returns over the last 10 years. I mean,
but he doesn't really want to be transparent.
No. He doesn't at all. But I think that eventually that there will be a drumbeat where he's not going to be able to just get away with this. Not that there's, I think just looking at what we have right now, it probably raises more questions than Mitt Romney had thought. I think eventually he's going to be pressured to release even more. As far as what he pays and what he makes, listen, I start with, I'm not going to begrudge anybody their wealth, but I think this is the reason why this is a problem for Mitt Romney is that he doesn't get it. He doesn't understand why this would be a problem, why paying such a low rate while, for instance, say his secretary or middle class, teachers, firefighters, policemen, what have you, pay much more. I don't think he understands why this would be a problem. And even worse, if he were the president of the United States, I think that he would do nothing to correct these inequalities and would probably push for even more inequalities. And I think that's why he's in the state that he is right now.
We're talking with Rodal Molyneux, who is the president of the American Bridge 21st Century American PAC, American Bridge PAC, and AmericanBridgePAC.org is the website. Mitt Romney, you're looking into the situation. What about Newt Gingrich? And I'm curious, there's talk about a brokered convention and what might come out of that would be Jeb Bush or Mitch Daniels. Mitch Daniels, of course, is giving the rebuttal tonight. In his state, they just passed a right to work for less law. It's passed through half the legislature. The other half will probably pass it today. And, he as governor, he's going to sign it maybe this week even, who knows. And, to bust up the unions in Indiana. And this is the guy that the Republicans are all looking to as, if all of their other candidates collapse, one of the guys. Have you looked into any of these other people?
Oh, we have. We've done extensive research on the whole lot of them, whether it be Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, Tim Pawlenty, Michelle Bachmann. As you know, most of them have fallen by the wayside.
Right.
Mitt Romney seems to be the one, along with Newt Gingrich. And I think Rick Santorum, just for the fact that he just kind of stood still for a long time and no one's really paying attention to him. And I think he's benefiting from the fact that so many others have spent so much money and fallen by the wayside.
Right.
You'd probably still have to say at this rate that Mitt Romney is the front runner, although shaky. I mean, in 24
sure.
hours, he lost the Iowa caucus and then lost the South Carolina primary. I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So
what do you know about Newt Gingrich that we need to know?
What do we know about? The funny thing about Newt Gingrich is that there are some things, whether it's his time at Fannie and Freddie or the fact that since he has left office, his opinion and his validation has pretty much been up to the highest bidder. I'll give you an example. Some people remember that he did a commercial a few years ago with Nancy Pelosi,
right.
calling on
for cap and trade.
Exactly, for cap and trade, more clean energy. About 3 or 4 months after that, one of the companies that he was helping to direct put out this treatise against cap and trade, saying that it was a bad idea, that it was going to kill jobs, and guess who got paid for that? That would be Newt Gingrich. So, Newt Gingrich, pretty much his.
Is that when he suddenly changed his opinion about cap and trade?
Yes, when someone else with more money. Came to him to help line his
With cap and trade, the people who make money are Wall Street, and the people who lose money are the oil companies. So apparently Wall Street was funding Newt when he made the ad with Nancy Pelosi, and then somebody else came, an oil company or some carbon industry people came along and said, here's a bigger check, Mr. Gingrich, and suddenly he's opposed to cap and trade. Is that the essence of
Yes.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, it is. And, the other thing about Newt Gingrich is that, people, and I think I'm sure, Tom, you don't, but I know a lot of people tend to forget just what a horrible speaker of the House, for as much as Newt likes to boast about his accomplishments, just how petty and destructive and his zeal to try to, as he said, drown Medicare in a bathtub.
No, that wasn't Newt who said that. Oh, Grover Norquist.
But Newt also echoed that as well. Has said it, but Newt has said that as well.
Amazing.
But the bigger point that I'm making is that I think that a lot of people have just forgotten what a destructive force Newt Gingrich was in the early to mid 90s. And should he continue to do well as he did in South Carolina, I think more and more of that will come out.
Yeah, well, a lot of younger voters aren't even old enough to remember it,
Exactly.
It's like there's a certain amount of amnesia that somebody who's In Newt Gingrich's case, somebody who's 67 years old can make use, you know, who had his major part of his political career in his 30s, 40s, and early 50s, can make use of, you know, the fact that, you know, there's a whole new generation who doesn't know who he is. He's reintroducing himself and reintroducing him, and he's reinventing himself the same way newts and salamanders can cut off an arm and it'll grow back. Here's Newt Gingrich reinventing himself. It's pretty amazing. Anything on Mitch Daniels? Am I asking you something, you know, off the top of your head that you don't have?
I mean, you are asking something, you know, earlier on, and actually, I gotta tell you, I always thought this was funny. It goes more to, the state of the Republican Party in that they really don't have strong candidates, maybe Mitt Romney being the strongest candidate. There was a point in time, you probably remember this, about 9 months ago when the Republicans were clamoring, if only Mitch Daniels would get into this, race, things would be much better. I think what people forget here is that Mitch Daniels is one of the architects of of President Bush's budget that got us into this mess in the first place.
You're right. He was the budget director, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was back there. He made those.
Thank you for the reminder. Rodel Molyneux, we've got to go, but people, check out your pack at AmericanBridgePack.org. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for having
me. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom. But I had totally forgot Mitch Daniels was Bush's budget director. Oh, what a mess that man made. Now he's governor of Indiana.
Now most folks, by every poll, think the rich should be taxed more, like 80% in the very top brackets, like they were before. I'm talking about in the good old days, the 50s and the 60s, when we all prospered somehow with no trickle-down booty trickery. The Limbaugh tried to tell you, you must be a socialist. If it ever even crosses your mind to raise taxes on the rich.
Hey now, how about them Dodgers and hey, violent crime? And I hear an asteroid could hit us just about any time. Let's talk about that Wiener and Rod Blagojevich. But don't you ever talk about raising taxes on the rich.
No, don't you ever talk about raising taxes on the rich. Scott in Portland listening on KPOJ. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, welcome. Greetings from a wet and cold Portland.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
I hope the river's not rising too fast there.
Yes, I had a little geeky science thing, but I wanted to, something you said a little bit ago about the well-intended wealthy, about how they aren't all trying to, you know, screw over the middle class.
No, there's a lot of good rich people.
One of my favorite moments a few years ago, Bill Gates Sr. was running around the country trying to drum up support for the estate tax.
Yep.
And he was on Charlie Rose, and at one point, Rose said, you know, you realize that you're advocating against your grandchildren when your son, their father, Bill Gates, dies, they're going to, you know, be taxed billions of dollars on their estate. And the senior leans across the table and says, Charlie, they'll be just fine.
Yeah, and he was right. He said something similar to that on this program. We've had Bill Gates Sr. on this program.
Yeah, it's true.
Yep. You know,
but anyway, my geeky science thing was an immature or a baby newt is referred to as an eft, E-F-T.
Oh, that's interesting.
Three-letter word, yeah. So what I'm thinking is that when Gingrich was a little boy, he was a little eft, and now that he's all grown up, he's all effed up.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Ba-dum bump. Scott, thanks a lot. Herman in Marathon, Wisconsin. Hey, Herman, what's up?
A realtor told me that with this health care bill, that the way they're going to try and finance some of it, they're going to slap a 3.8% sales tax on every piece of property that's sold. In other words, you sell a $100,000 home, and you would have to issue a $3,800 tax.
Yeah, I've read the viral right-wing emails about that, and that Obama's behind it, and it's going to be a federal tax and all that. There is no such proposal.
There isn't?
No.
Okay.
And by the way, those taxes are typically state taxes, so it's not inconceivable that in your state they're talking about raising the sales tax on things. But there's no national sales tax on real estate. That has been thoroughly debunked. It continues to live on among all the right-wing myths about how Obama's coming to get us. Now he's coming to get our house, and he's going to come and get our guns, and he's coming to, you know, all this other kind of stuff.
Yeah, all heard, too, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just a myth. Don't worry about it, Herman. Everything is fine. Bill in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, I was recently watching either Link or Free Speech TV, and they were covering the new way that Ford and GM and all that were remaking their companies. And they allow union workers and people who choose not to be union workers side by side, and it's working out very well. Now, in my family, my wife's father was a tool and die maker for 22 years. And when he worked, say, Christmas Eve or Christmas night, he made $120 an hour. So I think that there needs to be a limitation on the unions. I think unions are a great thing. They help the people. But we can't let it get out of control to where they are, you know what I mean? We have to be able to...
Let me flip that around, Bill. First of all, I would submit to you that, you know, a feel-good piece about how union and non-union workers working side by side is just another piece of non-union or anti-union, frankly, propaganda. Secondly, my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. And, yeah, the machinist union is a strong union, and they negotiated contracts where people would get double or triple overtime for working holidays or working nights or things like that. And so what that did, I mean, my dad, most of what he did most of those years was actually as the bookkeeper for that company. And what the company would have to decide is, okay, somebody comes to us and says, we need this job, and we need this job done right now. And the company says, okay, well, you know, if we have our people work overtime, it's going to cost us more to make it. So here's the additional cost to you. Do you want it so bad that you're willing to pay an extra 10% so that we can cover our labor costs or not? And if the customer says, yes, I want it that bad, I need it right now, I'll pay the extra labor costs, then who wins? The workers. I don't see why that is there's anything bad about that at all.
That's an excellent point. I didn't realize that extra pay for the union worker was being taken out of the other end.
It always is. It always is. I mean, you know, just think right now. If you try to, you know, you go to FedEx and you say, you know, I'd like something today. Well, that's cheaper. You want next day? That's more expensive. You want next day in the morning? That's even more expensive. Why? Because they're going to have more people working overnight on that thing. They may not be getting overtime. FedEx isn't a unionized operation, although UPS is. But the point is that when your labor costs go up, when something costs more to make, you raise the price on it. And the marketplace defines that. And I don't have any specific memory of when I was growing up, my dad ever working, you know, weekends or holidays. It was a little 12-man tool and die shop, and it mostly worked for Fisher Body and Oldsmobile. And so there probably weren't these wild swings like, you know, in your grandfather's experience. But the fact of the matter is that I don't have a problem with people being paid extra for working on Christmas or Christmas Eve. I think that they should be. I think, you know, it's an entirely appropriate thing, and you just pass the expenses along. And if you're in a kind of business where you can't pass the expenses along, you know, where your pay is fixed, then you try to, then you've got a business model that doesn't work.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out to me because I didn't realize that.
Okay. Thanks a lot,
and
Bill, for the call.
Can I make one quick point?
I'm sorry, Bill. We're out of time. It's when that machine starts. I don't start the machine. It starts all by itself. We have hard breaks on this program because of so many of our affiliates are nonprofit affiliates and they have to know exactly when the breaks are. So 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And more on Mitt Romney, the working class, Mitch Daniels, right to work for less, right after this. If I could find a way to see this trade, I'd run away to some fortune that I should have found by now. So I run not to the... Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is extraordinary. This is just extraordinary. Over at the Daily Kos, they're basically repeating a story or summarizing Jed Lewison doing a great job of summarizing a story that the Miami Herald is carrying today about how Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's company, earned, and that's in quotes, $342 million on an investment of $30 million. Now this is the difference between venture capital and private equity. which I will get to in just a minute, how they earned $342 million from investing $30 million in a company called Date International, which ultimately ended up going bankrupt and knocking 850 people in Miami alone out of work. Now, how do you make $342 million on an investment of $30 million? The fact of the matter is that most news media and most reporters are not, and the average American, obviously, clearly, is not sufficiently informed about the difference between venture capital and private equity to understand how it's possible that this kind of thing could happen. In fact, most Americans don't even know what venture capital is. It used to have another name. Back in the 1980s, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and companies started buying each other out like crazy, and it became a very fashionable thing to, you know, pump and dump, rip and strip. There were all kinds of phrases for it, to buy companies up, strip out their assets. These guys would go in, they'd look for a company where if you took the aggregate stock price, and let's say it was worth, you know, $300 million, but the company actually had $340 million worth of assets, you just buy the company for $300 million, liquidate it, sell it, take the $340 million, show a $40 million profit, and boom, you made money. It used to be called it used to be called vulture funds or vulture capitalism, and it was also called leveraged buyouts. Now, what I just described to you wasn't a leveraged buyout. That was just an old-fashioned strip and dump. But the leveraged buyout is really interesting, and this is how Mitt Romney made his money with Bain. Is they go to a company, and say the company's worth $1 billion. And they say, okay, we're going to buy this company for $1 billion. We'll put in $200 million, 20%. The other 80%, we're going to borrow from the bank, or we're going to borrow by selling bonds, but we're going to borrow. The debt is not going to be on the books of Bain. The debt is going to be on the books of the company. So all of a sudden, you know, people are working at a company. Everything's going along just fine. Hey, you know, we're in the, you know, fill in the blank business, the pharmaceutical business, the radio business, the factory business, the whatever it may be. And things are going cool. And all of a sudden the order comes down from above. You got to fire half your workforce, or you got to lay off anybody who's making, you know, good wages. Anybody who's been working there more than 15 or 20 years, you have to lay them off and replace them with new hires who are paid half as much. Why? Because the company has to make a debt payment. The company is now hundreds of millions of dollars in debt. And then over 5 or 10 years or whatever it is, the company pays off its own debt that was borrowed by Bain on its behalf. So now Bain has invested $200 million on a $1 billion company. They borrowed $800 billion. The company strips out of its own assets or gets lean and mean by downsizing its workforce and paying its workers less and asking them to work more hours. And they pay off that $800 million in debt. Now Bain owns a company worth $1 billion with no debt. Keep in mind, they put $200 million in to begin with. Then they sell the company. And they've got an $800 billion profit. That's how LBO, they used to be called leveraged buyout firms, LBO firms. And the leverage was that borrowing. And LBO got such a bad name in the 80s and 90s that there's actually a trade association for these companies, that they officially changed their name from leveraged buyout firms, LBO firms, to venture capital firms. And this is the bizarre, excuse me, to private equity firms. See, now I'm screwing it up. A venture capitalist is somebody, say you got $1 million sitting in the bank account, and somebody comes to you and says, I got a great idea for a business. I'd like to start it out. Would you give me $100,000 to start it? You say, great, here's $100,000. I'll take 10% of your company for that. And they say, fine. And then if the company grows into an Apple or a Microsoft, you get rich. Okay, that's what a venture capitalist does. That's completely different from what a private equity firm does. What a private equity firm does, which is what Bain is, which is Mitt Romney's company, is they do leveraged buyouts. And on the front page of today's Financial Times, the front page of today's Financial Times, above the fold, David Crum in New York, the headline, private equity fees called into question. Private equity has proved better at enriching its own managers than producing investment profits for U.S. pension funds over the past decade. Now, much of the money that they borrow is, you know, if when they're doing these leveraged buyouts, people will invest, right? That's putting the money into the company. And they pass it through the private equity company. But then the private equity company says, you know, we're going to take a fee for doing this work. Well, if most of the money is borrowed or most of the money is invested from outside sources and it's not actually coming from Bain, but Bain is taking a fee on the whole amount, which is how they do it. It's called calculating fees on committed capital as compared to invested capital. Now, I don't want to make your eyes glaze over, but basically the deal is that Bain takes a fee based on the whole deal. Debt and everything, all the stuff that Bain had nothing to do with. And so what they found is that Bain and many of these other companies, in fact, they say the industry faces mounting political scrutiny as its business model and favorable tax treatment. Mr. Romney will release his tax returns, blah, blah, blah. And they talk about how, assuming a normal 20% performance fee, this would amount to about 70% of gross investment performance being paid in fees over the past 10 years, according to Professor Martin Kremers of Yale. This is a guy that the Financial Times hired to look into how this thing works. 70% return on investment? So basically, this is a scam that Mitt Romney, you know, it's a legal scam, but it's a scam that these private equity firms run. So back to the story in today's DailyKos.com and Miami Herald. Via McKay Coppins, you can add the Miami Herald list, this Jed Lewis in writing in today's Kos, to the list of people and organizations who Mitt Romney says are attacking free enterprise. That's because today's edition takes a look at how Bain Capital earned, in quotes, $342 million from investing $30 million in the acquisition of medical technology firm Dade International. And not only that, the company went bankrupt. Anyway, they still took their $342 million in fees. You see how it works? They, you know, it's heads I win, tails you lose. If you're in the private equity business, which is why Mitt Romney makes in one day more than the average worker in America makes, and in one week makes enough to put him in the top 1% if he didn't make any income the rest of the year, and why he's paying 13.9% income tax on his income. It's incredible. It's just incredible. There's no way to say it beyond that. It's just incredible. Les in Lexington, Missouri. Hey, Les, what's up?
Well, Tom, I just want to make you aware of a little deal that went over in Kansas that the great Governor Brownback and the Kansas legislator has cut off all food stamps to children of illegal immigrants.
Oh my!
Even though they are American citizens.
Well. Oh, you mean the children who were born here of illegal immigrants?
Yeah, they're American citizens, but their food stamps are cut off because their parents are illegal aliens.
Amazing.
And they've already cut 2,100 kids off the rolls of food stamps in Kansas, the home of the Koch
brothers. Amazing. Yeah, you're right.
It's amazing what they'll do with, you know, $150 a kid per month, you know, that, and 2,000 kids, what's that, a couple $100,000.
Yeah.
And they've done without the food stamps now.
Yeah, that's astounding. I mean, Les, thanks for the heads up on that. It is, but, you know, you got to pay for the tax cuts for the billionaires and the corporations.
Yeah, and all those people in Indiana will be sorry they passed that law.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you, Les, on that. Frank in Chicago, minute of the break. Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you so much. You know, you give me so much, you know, the facts and the statistics. Okay, let me get to my point. I've been kicking it around with the term limits. Has to be. We have to talk about term limits. Some of these.
Frank, we have term limits. They're called elections.
Yeah, but you know, that's my second point. I've been in the politics since I was 15 years old in Chicago. But we have a culture of corruption. Some of these politicians were not elected. They were selected. A lot of elections were stolen. So,
this is why you need to show up and volunteer to be a precinct committee person in Chicago You know, participate.
I have been doing that. As a matter of fact, I'm with the Occupy right now, and Occupy means union. That's a blessing in disguise. But how do we, with the laws we have and the money they use against us?
Well, we've got to get the money out. No, I'm with you, Frank. We've got to get the money out of the system, and that means amending the U.S. Constitution to say that the Supreme Court was wrong when they said that money, which is property, is in fact speech or facilitates speech, and that corporations are people. They're simply wrong. And movetoamend.org is the place to go for that. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And movement politics is the kind of thing that makes these things happen, like Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org.
If you don't give back what you're taking more and more, you're bound to lose track of what you're taking it for. If you want a little more, you got to give it back.
There you go. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
How much, Tom? You?
Just great. Thank you.
Listen, it's little talked about that law that was passed in the 80s by Reagan that stated upon the sale of a corporation, its pension plan could be considered an asset of the company.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And that started all these buyouts. They were taking the pension plans and using them as down payments on buying the company.
Yep.
Now, what they did was, in their infinite wisdom with unions, see, my pension plan, I'm a retired Teamster.
Mm-hmm.
My pension plan is held by an outside entity, the union. But the government passed laws because of the corruption, because of the mob influence on union pensions with the Teamsters. They said that we couldn't invest our pension money in anything risky. It had to be in low investment.
Right.
2-3% interest bearing.
Right, low risk
investment. Well, in their infinite wisdom, what they did was they saved our pension plan from the destruction of the stock market.
You're right.
Because they were trying to punish us because they thought money was dangerous.
Yeah.
And they saved our pension fund from that disaster in the 70s.
Yep. Yep.
And 80s.
And a fine thing it is. And that's the point you wanted to make, Corky?
Well, that's what I want to say. That's what Romney was involved in all this, these buyouts and taking pension plans. That's why they had to set up the guaranteed pension fund.
Right. And that's why this the first sentence of today's Financial Times article on the front page, private equity fees called into question, says private equity has proved better at enriching its own managers than producing investment profits for U.S. pension funds over the past decade, according to a study prepared by the Financial Times.
I got the math calculations for it.
Yeah.
The pension fund, now I get $2,400 a month from my Teamster pension.
Right.
Under the pension guaranteed fund, if my fund goes bust, I'll get $35 a month for every year that I work there.
Right.
So I worked there 15 years. My pension would go from $2,400 down to $650.
Right, but if your pension got wiped out by Bain Capital or one of these private equity firms using it as the leverage to leverage buyout a company that then goes out, then, yeah, your pension goes down, but they get to take their fees no matter what, like they did in this case with Dade International, where Bain Capital, Mitt Romney's company, took $342 million in fees on a $30 million investment, and then bankrupted the company. Excellent point, Corky. Well said and well made. Thank you, Paul in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Your quotes of the Miami paper have kind of taken my point, but I was just going to say that, and I realize it's rather nitpicky, but I think that terming Mitt Romney's income as earned is offensive. I think that's something that people who work for a living do, is earn money.
Yeah.
And I was trying to come up with the right word for it, and I can't, you know, I'm not exactly sure what's right, but the one that has the right feel to me, even though it may not be correct, is like maybe congealed or something with that kind of connotation.
Amassed.
What's that?
Amassed.
But something amassed sounds so neutral and you know, could be kind of pleasant.
Yeah.
You know, squirrels amassing peanuts. It's got to be something like pond scum congealing on your cup of coffee that you left out. You know, something.
You're the master of the metaphor,
really
Paul.
Evokes what Mitt Romney does and stands for.
Okay, got it. Thank you very much, Paul. Great to hear from you. Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Hey there, Professor Hartman or Brother Tom. Hey, the word is kasnickered.
Kasnickered?
Kasnickered.
That's
you
how.
Know,
that's
how. On the first part of the word.
That's how Mitt Romney makes his money. He kasnickers people.
Yeah, that's about G.W. Bush. You know, he kasnickered people when
okay.
I worked for him. Hey, anyways, the worst scenario would be Newt and Mitt or vice versa running.
But.
You know, Newt Gingrich and. I'm trying to listen to you and talk at the same time.
Yeah, that's why
I'm
you
got to
turn your TV down. You can't do that,
I'm
Sam.
I'm
going
to turn it. okay. I think that Newt Gingrich's idol was Tricky Dickie Nixon, and Bill Clinton's was John F. Kennedy's.
Yep.
Because I know they both visited them
yep.
at a young age.
Yep.
And they mentored them. I mean, the president, Nixon, mentored Gingrich, and Kennedy mentored Clinton.
Or at least we're role models.
That's who they looked up to.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Or at least we're role models for them. No, I think you're absolutely
yeah.
right, Sam, and very well said. Thank you very much for sharing with us. Harold in Shelnob, Missouri. Hey, Harold, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was listening to the lady from South Carolina, and she was talking about that all working people usually live from payday to payday.
Yeah.
So everything that they make in salary or wages, they dispose of.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do, we have to buy all this expensive, overpriced stuff that allows these corporations and the people who run the thing to have all of this money as a result. To buy our politicians.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Harold. A point well made. Thank you, Mark in Los Angeles. Last minute for this hour. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. I just wondered. I was listening to you talk a couple minutes ago, and you mentioned how FedEx is non-union and UPS is union.
Right.
And I just from that, I'm always going to send things UPS now.
Yeah, I do.
I was just thinking that it would be a good idea. I don't know if you could post it on your website or give a source or something of companies that are union and companies that are not so that I can vote with my dollar.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's a good one. Actually, I shouldn't say I always use UPS because occasionally it's just, you know, you got no choice. But when given a choice, I pick UPS because it's a union company and they're not, and it's a company that's not trying to bust their unions. And FedEx is aggressively, management is aggressively trying to prevent a union from coming in. So, to the best of my knowledge, I may be wrong on that, or that information may be dated by a year or so, but it certainly was the case the last time I had somebody on who was talking about this issue. So, anyhow, up next, some Americans are preparing for the collapse of civilization. And we're not just talking about the people who think 2012 in the Mayan calendar. We're talking a civilization. We're going to talk to one of these people next. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So, is it all about to fall apart? Are we headed for a crash that could make 1932 look like a picnic? Are we heading for a crash that could make the Black Plague look like it was a good thing? And if so, what do we do? And now, Mitt Romney has a year worth of food stashed in his basement. And so do every one of his children and grandchildren. This is like pretty much a requirement if you're a Mormon. And this has been going on since the 1800s. Get ready. It's coming. But this is not just a religious thing. There's a whole secular part to this. Jim Rawls is on the line with us. He's the editor of survivalblog.com, the author of several books, including How to Survive the End of the World as We Know It. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So what do you envision coming, and what is it that you are doing about it? as individually or the people who participate in survivalblog.com?
Well, there's a number of different threats out there, and I think it's just rational self-interest that motivates people like myself to prepare. There's the threat of an economic collapse that could be triggered by a global credit crisis. We could very well see that in the very near future, something along the lines of what happened in 2008, but only worse, and that could trigger a whole cascade of events, everything from margin calls to bank runs to stock and bond market collapses. It could get very ugly.
Right.
That's probably at the forefront of everyone's mind.
But
right
we
now.
Had that here in 1929, and you know, people stood in bread lines and soup lines and things like that, and eventually Franklin Roosevelt put into place some social safety net programs, that's some of which survive to this day. But we didn't have riots in the streets. We didn't have people shooting each other.
But Tom, in the 1930s, probably 20% of the population was still living off the land, is actively involved in farming and ranching.
Right, now it's about 2%.
Yeah, at most. We have 1 or 2% of the population feeding the other 98%.
Right.
We have very long chains of supply. We have a much more technologically complex society with long chains of supply, automated ordering systems that are dependent on the Internet, very lean management, inventory control management with the Japanese Kanban system, where what you see on the grocery store shelves is all they have. There is no longer a back room, you know, with cases and cases of food. It just doesn't
right.
exist anymore.
Right.
The other factor
just-in-time delivery, it's called.
Yeah, just-in-time or what they call Kanban inventory
yeah.
control. The other factor is in the 1930s, we still had a fairly polite society. Now we have a society where, you know, there's practically a riot every time a local sports team either wins or loses a big game. So I don't think there's a lot of civility left in our society. And I think that if we do have a major economic cataclysm, that people are less likely to stay law-abiding.
But when you look at, you know, the Fox News narrative set aside, because it turns out in retrospect to have been such a false narrative. When you look at what happened in New Orleans, for example, during Katrina, you had there was virtually no civil unrest. In fact, the most horrible, violent things that were happening was white vigilantes coming into town shooting people for fun, and some of them were being prosecuted for that. It seems like Americans are still of the mind that when all hell breaks loose, we band together. We help each other out.
Generally, yes. But unfortunately,
isn't it more important to help?
Do get engaged in looting. And in fact, in New Orleans, there were even police officers that were looting. And
I wouldn't call that looting. I mean, you know, when a city has been shut down and there's no food, what are you going to do? Whatever we want to call it, isn't it more important to get involved and build a civil society and build
Absolutely.
A less fragile society rather than being a survivalist and going out and getting, you know, 100 acres
in
Wyoming or something?
If you look at the survivalist movement and then the whole back to the land resiliency movement,
right.
There's a lot of people that are pushing toward developing truly self-sufficient, resilient communities where the majority of the food is grown within, a 20 or 30-mile radius of a city.
Sure, even urban farming. I mean, this is happening in Brooklyn and Detroit right now.
Sure, and I think that's a good thing. Obviously, I think there's a lot of buildings that need to be torn down in Detroit, and a lot of that land originally was farm and dairy land.
Yep.
It could be put back to that use.
It is. It is being, actually.
Yeah.
You know, these urban farms, yeah.
I think this is an issue that really transcends left and right,
mm-hmm.
and it transcends religious and non-religious. Most people, if they sit down and look at all the threats that exist, whether you know everything from a solar flare to economic collapse to biological warfare to a naturally existing occurring pandemic, like a new strain of influenza. There's all kinds of different threats out there, but if people have common sense, they'll recognize that they really have to depend on themselves and their local communities to pull through.
Right. So shouldn't instead of being survivalists, or instead of like the mentality that's promoted by Glenn Beck and who's a Mormon, or Mitt Romney, or the Mormon religion of, you know, be ready for your own family. And actually, I shouldn't speak for the Mormons. I'm not a Mormon. I don't know enough about them to speak of them. But shouldn't
they? Actually, the Mormons are quite charitable, and they. I'm not a Mormon either. But in their defense, I must say that they've established the equivalent of a food bank on steroids. They have what they call a bishop storehouse system,
right?
With large warehouses full of food that they intend
plus,
to dispense in charity.
Plus, every family has a year's worth of food in their basement.
Right.
But what about
each year's supply of food that one individual families have in their basement represents two things. One is they are going to be one less family that's rushing to the grocery stores at the 11th hour and cleaning out the shelves.
Right.
So they're part of the solution. The other thing is for families like mine, where I have almost a 3-year supply of food, I don't look at that as a 3-year supply for one family. I look at that as a 1-year supply for 3 families.
Okay.
It's very important to be charitable.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree with you on that. We're talking with Jim Rawls, survivalblog.com. Jim, what could, you know, and you went through the list of the things that could provoke, I suppose, a crisis, but a crisis that would produce civil unrest. What are your thoughts on the guys who are saying get guns?
We
have just 1 minute
wise,
left. But
actually, we live in a society where the police cannot respond in a timely manner, and if we're in a major emergency where there's a disruption of power and communications, the response time for police could be stretch out into hours or even days. So I think it's prudent for people to arm themselves. People shouldn't live with a whole mentality of fear.
Well, it seems to me like that.
It's like carrying an umbrella, you know.
Well, I don't carry an umbrella when it's not raining.
Well, but you own an umbrella, right?
Yeah, I do.
You recognize the fact that rain can exist.
Yeah.
I look at it as an.
It's just I don't center my life around my umbrella. I guess that's what I'm saying, and that's the thing. It just seems to me that we should be working hard to build a resilient and civil society rather than getting ready to bail out of it. But.
Well, I don't plan to bail out of society. I plan to be there to help be part of the solution.
So you're suggesting we should do both.
Yep.
Jim Rawls, survivalblog.com. You can read all about it. The editor of Survival Blog. Jim, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Interesting conversation. And good luck to you. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You think civilization is going to collapse? Should we be stashing food in our basements? Do you even have a basement? Tom Harbin here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Larry in Calamar, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, this is your favorite PhD student, Tom Hartman, you.
Okay, yeah. What's up, Larry?
Hey, now my theory of the end of the world here this year, I studied astronomy in college and learned all about this, but the right shoulder of Orion, the constellation, the Sagittarius constellation, is a blue or a red giant called Betelgeuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I predict that it's like really, really old. It should blow any time, go supernova.
Right.
And when that happens, the cosmic radiation from that blast will come through our solar system and just scorch every. I mean, it'll just burn us all up. And
well, so, our own sun is gonna go supernova. I mean, it's gonna take another 5 billion years, but everything everything is part of the great cycles of life. I'm not sure that I'm gonna change my life because of that. When we're in the midst right now, literally today. We're being hit by a massive solar flare that erupted yesterday. The particles are now hitting us as we speak. And in fact, they're rerouting last night and tonight. They're rerouting a lot of flights over the polar region because the radiation is so intense the planes that would have gone over the North Pole are going to, you know, skirt the northern continents, even though it consumes more fuel because of that radiation. But, you know, life goes
on. Beetlejuice is huge.
Beetlejuice is huge. Okay, so you think Beetlejuice is going to eat our lunch. Okay, got it. Thanks a lot, Larry. Dan in Sterling Heights, Michigan. Hey, Dan, what's up? Thanks for listening to DTW.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, good on you for a little-known skill, which is having and expressing some empathy, and I really appreciate you for it.
Thank you.
As I told the screener, I worked on Wall Street for the Chase Bank back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a time when there was such a thing as short-term capital gains and long-term capital gains.
That's right. If you held a stock for more than a year, then you could have a reduced, that 1 year, those periods of time varied over the last 50 years. But if you held a stock for a long period of time, then you got a lower tax rate. And if you held it for a short period of time, you paid ordinary income tax on it or something close to it. Yeah.
And I think what's happened is it's connected to a lot of different things. One, obviously, it's connected to Mitt, you know, and his accumulation of wealth and people like him. Second of all, it really has contributed to the volatility in our markets, right? Because now you have a bunch of people who say, you know, day traders, more or less, right? But on a grander scale. And I think that it has led to higher risk in the market, volatility in the market, uncertainty in the market as it relates to money supply and the cost of capital. And I think it just has long-term, really sort of cancerous effects on the financial system and then, you know, the broader economy in general.
I agree. And this is why we need both to either go back to a divided system like that or simply tax capital gains at ordinary income rates, number one. And number two, perhaps more importantly, because 70% of all the activity in the New York Stock Exchange every day is not just day traders. It's these high-frequency traders where they'll literally trade, you know, 10,000 stocks a second and make a hundredth of a penny on a stock and trade it in 2 seconds and you know, through the course of the day, make millions of dollars. And if that's more than half of all the activity in the stock market, that's very, very volatile. That is just like so dangerous. And that's why we need a set tax, a security transaction excise tax. It's what it used to be called. Now they're calling it the Robin Hood tax. And of very, very small, you know, 0.1% on a trade. It's something that people who have money invested in the market for their retirement would never even notice, even if you rolled over your 401k or your individual investments or whatever a couple of times a year. It might cost you $5. But for somebody who's making $1 million a minute doing high frequency trading, it's gonna bite them really badly. In fact, it's gonna bite them more than what they're making. And it'll slow that insanity of the marketplace down. Excellent point, Dan. Thanks for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out a few things that the guy at the End of Civilization guest missed, namely peak oil, overpopulation, global warming, and the nature of our economy.
Yeah.
Beginning with the nature of our economy, it's based on the assumption that it needs to keep growing in order to keep us successful and as a society.
Right.
And living on a finite planet, that's not possible.
Yes.
That's just basic math.
Well, unless
global warming.
Hang on just a second. Let me just challenge that, if I may. And I'm somebody who's been a longtime advocate of sustainable economic policies. But I think that you can grow an economy in terms of quality without growing the economy in terms of waste. You're absolutely right that human beings are the only species on Earth, plant, animal, bacteria, whatever it may be, whose waste is not somebody else's food. And therefore, everything else on Earth, and human beings up until 10,000 years ago, our waste was somebody else's food. But or arguably up until maybe even a few hundred years ago, the Industrial Revolution. And so now that we're producing waste that can't be recycled by the planet, that isn't something else's food, there will reach the point where, you know, it's like running a horizontal line through a circle where it punctures the edge of the circle. But I think that it's possible to have growth that isn't extending that horizontal line. For example, stop using fossil fuels and start using solar cells and then start using that solar energy to power the factories that make the solar cells.
Right, but there's still the problem of plastics. I mean,
we're never going to get away from plastics, that we rely on them for so many things.
That's what they used to say about kerosene lamps and the danger that kerosene lamps would burn your house down. Well, we're never going to get away from them. Well, we did. We'll come up with something.
That's true, but the powers that be that run the world right now, the large corporations, just don't want to invest in anything new. And we live in a society that's based on fossil fuels, and there's nothing in the horizon that's even capable of sustaining us in our current capacity. And that could replace fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And besides that, I want to move on to the other things I said, the global warming that's increasingly becoming more and more of a problem. Overpopulation. We're overpopulated back in during the Civil
War.
I
don't disagree with you, Noah, although I don't think that those are reasons for us to hide. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In fact, if anything, those are the reasons for us to get more engaged in the political process, which is the lever where we can actually make some change in these things. Up next, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very numerously ugly. The good. Chicago resident Ryan Garcia. Garcia, a 30-year-old sales rep from Chicago, has made a very unusual New Year's resolution. Do a random act of kindness each day this year. The inspiration for this unique and heartwarming resolution comes from Garcia's newborn daughter, who he hopes to influence and be an excellent role model for. Already, Garcia has sent letters to soldiers in Afghanistan, raised awareness for cancer, and bought and distributed dozens of pairs of socks and gloves to homeless residents of Chicago. He's even set up a website where people can comment on his mission, as well as suggest new random acts of kindness. Maybe Republicans should take note and remove their website pledging to cut one government program each week that provides the same sort of kindness. Check out Ryan's blog and send him ideas at 366randomacts.org. The bad. Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. Last week, Governor Beshear proposed his 2012-2013 budget, prefacing it by saying, "We should be making substantial investments in our physical and intellectual infrastructure to bring transformational change to our state." Well, that all sounds very good. But the budget actually cuts funding to an already underfunded education system by 6.4%. At the same time, Governor Beshear was quick to preserve the tax breaks given to a biblically themed amusement park in the state. So while the government was adamant about investing in the state's intellectual well-being, he decided to invest in what critics are now calling an ARC park. Not only is this a blatant misuse of taxpayer money to support religious theme parks, it also sets his state and this nation backwards when it comes to being able to compete in the global economy. And the very, very ugly, the cat killer in Russellville, Arkansas. Jacob Burris, the campaign manager for a congressional candidate in Northwest Arkansas, told the police Monday that he found his family's cat brutally slaughtered over the weekend with the word liberal painted on the corpse. Burris lives in a heavily conservative portion of Arkansas and is the campaign manager for Ken Aden, who's hoping to win the seat of freshman Republican Representative Steve Womack. In a statement to the press, Aden said, "It is one thing to engage in civil political discourse and for Republicans and Democrats to disagree with each other, which is an expected part of the political process. Taking it to this level is beyond unacceptable." Mr. Aden is absolutely right. Taking political discourse to the level of savagely killing an animal just to make some sort of political statement has no place in our society and is very, very ugly. Well, that is incredible. I don't know if you've seen the picture of that cat. It doesn't get worse than that. It's Bill in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was wondering how much capital you would need in order to generate income of 24 mil, which is what Romney's income was.
I think it was 40 million, wasn't it?
Okay, 40.
Whatever.
How much capital would it take to do that?
Well, I don't know.
It might be cheaper for him to just pay every taxpayer he wants to vote for him directly
million dollars.
Well, that's kind of what, I don't want to say that's what Mayor Bloomberg did in New York. He actually spent it campaigning, but spent something like $70 per vote that he got. I mean, and increasingly that's happening all across the country. But, for example, Bain Capital earned $342 million on a $30 million investment in a medical technology firm called Data International down in Florida. And then after they had made their $342 million, they had earned their $342 million in consulting fees, they shut down the company and laid off a bunch of people, 800 people down in Florida, 850 actually in Miami. So,
yeah. Some people call that venture capitalism.
No, it's not venture capital. It's private equity, and there's a difference. Venture capital is where you know, somebody comes to you with an idea for an invention. You know, Steve Jobs came to you and said, hey, I think I've got this thing. I want to make an Apple computer. And you said, great. You know, you don't have the money to do it, but I do. So here's some money, and I'll take a piece of your company in exchange for it. That's venture capital. What this is called private equity. It used to be called leveraged buyouts. And what it is acquiring a company by having that company borrow the money so that you can acquire it with very, very little skin in the game. So if it goes down in flames, you don't lose much. And if it makes money, you make a whole awful lot. And even if it goes out of business, you charge enough fees that you've recovered whatever your initial investment was. So it's a rigged game, and private equity, people need to get it. Private equity is not venture capital. Private equity used to be called leveraged buyouts, and it is a nasty business, and it's the business that Mitt Romney's in. Thanks a lot for the call, Bill. Good point. Don in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I watch you every day, and I appreciate you. I want to ask you a question. Why do you think Republican voters constantly vote against their best interests? They vote against things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah. Well, in part, it's because they're lied to. You know, they're told that Social Security is going broke when actually there's $2.7 trillion in the trust fund, and it's doing just fine. Thank you very much, and will for the next 25, 27 years. And even then, it'll pay out 80% forever if we do nothing, and there's a bunch of things we can do. So, number one, they're lied to. And number two, they're distracted. They you know, the issues of God, guns, gays, you know, the classic wedge issues are used by Republicans more frequently than Democrats, because they're, you know, the Republicans need to distract people from the economic issues that they're talking about. So, you know, Don, you know, look around you in Little Rock. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of people who are voting on those kinds of issues. You know, oh, he's a good Christian man, or oh, he's going to protect my guns or whatever. Or they're afraid. You know, they've been getting these right wing emails saying Obama wants to take your guns, when actually he's been probably less intrusive on guns than Reagan and Bush Sr. were. You know, who actually passed legislation to stop assault weapons. So, you know, frankly, I think that's what's going on, and we need to wake up from it. Thanks a lot for the call. Janet in Gustine, California. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Yes, it's a point that bothers me a lot. Mm-hmm. You used the word growth when you talked to the gentleman previous to the news broadcast, and I don't think we ought to use that word, because it, for many people, it has a different connotation. I think you should be using the word development when you talk about sustainable living.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah. Point taken. I can't guarantee it'll stick in my brain forever, but I understand your point. Unrestrained and unlimited growth in biological systems we call cancer. And development, you know, we call, it's like developing from a child to an adult. Yeah, I'm with you. Thank you, Janet. Thank you very much. And very interesting. Caleb in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's up?
I agree with you about that cat killing. I have a cat, too, and is in Higgins, and boy, that's appalling. First of all, I got a shout-out to the chat room, all the wonderful people there in the chat room. And
me
terrific
too.
Chat room you have. And, Tom, you know, let's say that you were going to buy a company that you're working for Bain. Would you be satisfied in only looking back of 1 year of returns of financials and the hope for financials of this year? You would not. I mean, Mitt Romney would not buy such a company. He'd want to look at the history of the thing. We're buying a guy for president. Why don't we sort of have the same rules for Mitt Romney that he would for a company he's taking over?
Oh, that we want to see more than 1 year of tax returns.
Yeah, you betcha.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, anyone can rig the books for a year or two, and he knows it. That's why he would not want only a year. He'd want it to go back a lot further.
Yeah. Good point, Caleb. Excellent point. Thank you for making it. Christian in Westminster, Maryland. Hey, Christian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to call in. I heard earlier that somebody had called in expressing some concern about the star Betelgeuse exploding.
Yeah.
My background is in astrophysics, so I thought I would just quickly clear this one up in case there are any listeners out there who are actually concerned about that.
Okay.
Basically, every couple of years, you know, the Huffington Post had this on their site where they were talking about in 2012, Betelgeuse would explode and, you know, all this stuff would happen. Well, Betelgeuse is a supergiant star. It could explode any day, any week, or any millennia from now, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to. And truth to be told is that, you know, it's between 600 and 800 light years away. So it's going to be really cool when it does blow up. If we're lucky enough to be alive to see it, we'll see a very
It'll light up
star.
Our sky a little bit, yeah.
Well, yeah, it'll be about as bright as the full moon, but concentrated into the size of a star. So,
right.
You know, it might sting your eyes a little bit if you look directly at it, but you'll be able to see it during the day. It'll be a really cool sight. But,
yeah.
You know, truth be told is that between 600 and 800 light years, a star's got to be a giant star, by the way, not a star like our sun, but something that's about 20 times more massive, which is what Betelgeuse is, would have to be well within maybe like a dozen light years before any real damage could be done to Earth.
Okay.
And
in fact, aren't there historical records that strongly suggest that there have been supernova, you know, close enough to us that they have been as bright as or nearly as bright as the moon before that humans have seen?
Well, yeah, I think you might be thinking about, you know, Tycho supernova, which was, I think, in 1640. And, you know, he regarded it as being as something as bright that could be seen. I believe it was able to be seen during the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient Chinese discovered, a star that is now, located in the position of M1, the Crab Nebula. So you can actually look through a telescope and you would see the remnant of this thing that blew up, and they were able to spot this in broad daylight. That's how bright it was. So we do see these from time to time. They are kind of rare. And
we're still around.
Last I checked.
Yeah.
now you did mention that the sun like will go supernova. Actually, the sun will meet its demise, and it won't actually go supernova. It'll swell up to become a red giant, and that would pretty much mean the end of everything here on Earth.
But and that's like that's, 5 billion years down the road?
Yeah, about 5 billion years or so, give or take.
That was my recollection. Okay, Christian, thank you for the dose of reality. Appreciate
it. My pleasure, Tom.
Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's going on in the world. And Washington, D.C. veterans.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we're going to pick up Ellen Ratner in just a moment with the Talk Radio News Service, but first, David in Austin, Texas. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You're promoting the constitutional amendment to take personhood away from corporations and eliminate their right to donate to political campaigns, and I'm all with you on that, but it takes a two-thirds majority of the House and Senate plus passage from two-thirds of the state legislatures.
Three-quarters of the state legislators
in order to accomplish that. And aren't we asking the same politicians corrupted by corporate money to change the system so they don't get corporate money anymore?
Yes.
How is that supposed to work?
Well, here's how it works, and here's why I have hope for it. Just like with the constitutional amendment that was passed in less than 6 months to allow 18-year-olds to vote. First of all, there was an enormous pressure. The Vietnam War was on, and there was an enormous pressure. People, you know, they had that song, Time of Destruction or Seeds of Destruction or whatever it was, and it had the line in it that said, say that again? Eve of Destruction. That's what it was. Thank you, Jacob. And it had that line in it that said, you know, you're old enough to kill but not for voting. And that created this national movement. I mean, people kind of woke up and said, hey, wait a minute, that's crazy. So I think, number one, if enough people wake up and say, hey, wait a minute, corporations are people and money is speech, that's crazy. Money is property and corporations are legal abstraction. But secondly, I'll tell you, the Republican and Democratic politicians that I have met, and Ellen knows a lot more of them than I do, and we'll ask her about this right after this call, that I have met in this town hate the fact they have to spend half of every day in some office building off the premises of the Capitol building dialing for dollars, literally half of every day, anywhere from 30 to 70% of every day, depending on, you know, what size the state is and how big the race is and who they're going up against. And so it's a transpartisan issue. Republicans hate doing the fundraising. Democrats hate doing the fundraising. And wouldn't it be great if ultimately something came before them where they could all just say, okay, that's it. We're going to get rid of these corporate interests. So that's my hope, David. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, what do you think about that?
You know, it's outrageous because we see a lot of the guys, both Democrats and Republicans, coming on the elevator doing their fundraising every day, and they hate it. And you
right
know,
here in this building.
I am told that Barack Obama's office was in this building.
Oh, really?
When he was a senator, and he had to come over and dial for dollars.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's
and
totally
none of them
crazy.
Like it. The Republicans don't like it. I mean, there might be a few Duke Cunninghams out there who think they can game the system, but very few.
Yeah, okay. Well, the president is giving a State of the Union address tonight. Mr. Priebus, who's the chair of the Republican National Committee, he said, the president is king of promises. The problem is he never follows through. Now, listen to this. He said he's going to reduce unemployment to 8% or less, create a large number of green jobs, cut the deficit and the national debt, and reduce health care costs. Wait a minute. Wasn't it the Republicans that have gotten in the way of every time the president tries to do a job bill or do some kind of reform of health care so that there can be costs?
Right.
I mean,
And in the meantime,
how does this guy
by the way,
say that with a straight face?
Well, and in the meantime, we've had 22 consecutive months of job creation, 3.5 million jobs. Unemployment is in the 8% and change range. The economy, this is not to say the economy is wonderful or anything, but I mean,
right. Well, it's interesting. Now the Republicans are going to unveil their own ad this week called State of Our Union. And they're going to do it in North Carolina, Virginia, Michigan, and Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., obviously. And they're not going to get any votes here. It's just that they're doing it to
shove it in their face.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. The White House is now, they talked a little bit to some of the press this morning, Newsweek magazine among them. And they said, well, the State of the Union doesn't really lend itself to speeches of the ages, and yes, it has to be done, but this isn't really his main speech. So they're sort of trying to downplay the State of the Union because everybody
Lincoln's asking us to appeal to our better angels. Was the speech of the ages?
Yeah, I guess so. Okay, so
actually, that was an inaugural.
No, it was. That's right. It was not a State of the Union.
Yeah,
State of
right.
the Unions haven't generally been such big speeches. I do agree with that. Okay, John Boehner had his own press conference, the Speaker of the House today, and he said, well, his read of the presidential speech is we're just going to double down on what hasn't worked. His policies have failed. As a matter of fact, his policies have made the economy worse. And he said, we know that there's a reason I was talking now about what was going on with the Romney press release of his of his finances. And he says, basically, there's a reason we have a low capital gains. It spurs investment in our economy. Now, speaking of Romney and the taxes today. One thing that came out this morning that has not made it to a lot of the mainstream press, you may know about this, is that he also, until he decided to run for president, had a Swiss bank account.
I told the story earlier in the show, about an hour and a half ago. I'll very quickly tell it again. When I lived in Germany back in the 80s, I always, you know, you always hear about Swiss bank accounts. And so I thought, it must be really cool. And so I had to have a foreign bank account. So I contacted a Swiss bank and said, you know, I'd like to open a banking account. They said, great, we charge you 3% interest. You have to pay the Swiss bank to have a bank account. They don't pay you interest. And I'm like, why is that? Well, because we'll keep it secret.
That's right. So then when he knew he was running for president, he dumped out of that.
Right.
I mean, so much for this, you know, blind trust, whatever,
right,
whatever. It wasn't too blind, I guess. Okay. The other thing is the Republicans are today after the president's budget. It is legally due out February 6th. It's going to be a week late. The Republicans are saying this is because the president doesn't have a plan. I mean, come on, give me a break. Anybody who knows the intricacies of that budget, and it has to be, it's printed by the printing office. It has to go on the internet. I mean, give me a break. Okay. The other thing is that there's a whole long list today of people who are going to be in the president's box. One of them is a woman who's a colonel in special forces, I believe, and she and her partner there, was the first one when she had her upgrade to colonel, are going to be there. Warren Buffett's secretary is going to be there. Gabby Gifford's husband is going to be there, as well as the mayor of San Antonio, Texas, which is doing a government, essentially city of San Antonio, Texas, plan to get jobs in his area. Lots of very interesting people in the president's box tonight.
That's great. That's great. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by Ellen's new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Radner and Ann Gaiman. Thank you, Ellen. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.